Sex Bob-omb, and we're here to make you think about death and get sad and stuff.
I'm hearing voices, animal voices, the tremor of cold, the feminine episode, reaching my threshold, staring at the truth till I'm blind.
Welcome to this very special episode of After Rot. It's an experiment. Experimentally speaking, that is. I have no intention of trying to bear the barrier of effervescence, but I do want to try. So sit back, chill the cool off a beverage of a sort, some sort or other, and pull out your ear-thinking units as journey we into the wacky, wild world of what the fiddle-faddle kind of thought spaces I'm going to wander through today. So, I put out on the web couple of requests for some information to say, hey, what kind of things would be interesting to talk about? So that is what I'm going to do today, is I'm going to talk about a few interesting things, and I'm going to share an opinion. It's probably going to be mine. It may even be shared by some people, but it might not. I don't know. This is kind of like the whole experiment, you know, as the experimentally speaking part of that expression goes. It's a thing. I don't know, we'll see how it goes. So the first thing was, what about the chocolate levels in Canadian cookies? Why is it so amazing? Well, it's because it's from Canada, and therefore by ipso facto ergo sum theorem there go forest, that's by definition, in and of itself, that is the reason why they are amazing. They are amazing because I actually don't know any particular reason why, they just are. Cookies in Canada, you know these things, they're called Fudgios. It's put out by the same company that puts out Oreos. Now, Oreos are available in the States, but Fudgios are not. Well, most of the States. I think a couple in the northern states, like right on the border of Canada, can get them as well. But they are, as far as I'm concerned, they are the best packaged cookie you can get on the market that is not meant to be like a homemade style cookie, because you can't make them homemade, because it's like, why do you put that kind of thing together, you know? So, I mean, obviously mom's homemade cookies are the best, but barring that, like I said, packaged cookies, Fudgios. If you get the opportunity, if you ever see me at a convention, by all means, ask me for a Fudgio cookie, because I'll probably have some with me. And anybody who's ever met me at a convention can probably guarantee that no. Yes, I had Fudgio cookies available, and I share them. The only instances when I do share my cookies are at conventions. You know what I mean? So it's always a very important thing to get in long in that line, because you know it's an important part of a complete zombie diet. Cookies, they're in you for me to eat you out of your brains. So, other parts of this episode tonight are going to be what we call random. Spiraling sparrows and the world that sings at night. The worlds within the shadows are always moving at breakneck speeds. Faster and faster and faster they go. Where they trip into the abyss, nobody knows. We are the engines of destruction, bringing closer to the edge the machinations of construction. Each side of the coin, building and destroying, is a part of the cycle of existence. Create, wreak havoc, cry fair game, and unleash the cookies of doom. There will never be enough carbohydrates to fill this room. And moving from that particular point of ipso facto thinky thought, kind of, I don't know what you want to call that, but that was the thing, what it is. I want to talk about the viability and future potential of space flight becoming more commercialized in 20 years from now. Well, I mean, this is kind of a given thing that what's going to happen, or what is happening right now, we have all of these SpaceX and Virgin Airlines and all that stuff trying to make a commercial platform for space flight, for tourism, for commercial endeavors, mining, whatever else, you know, you want to call it that. And that really is the potential, because have you not seen the movie Space Family Robinson? Chuckle, chuckle, chuckle. The world's resources completely, totally ruined and whatever. Let's find another planet to live on, another place. Build a place. I don't know if you're going to build a place, and if you can't even build a place, find another place and ruin that place too. You know, that's kind of the human way to do things. And people wonder why zombies are not a part of the future of the world. Well, we are. We are the future. Zombies are the future. You know? no matter which direction you take life, no matter which direction you take society, in and of itself, that whole burgeoning resource of human interaction, social construction, that all sort of gears towards that whole byplay of how zombies work. Because zombies, they're in you, they're out of you, they're with you, they're around you, and we're everywhere. Everywhere you've ever been, everywhere you're going to go, this is what's going to happen. Zombies will follow and eat your brains. And after we've eaten your brains, we'll make more zombies. And after we've made all the zombies, well, then everybody goes to sleep, and it's a very happy, happy land in zombie land, because that's where it all going to be, and that's where we're all going to land. Yay! With or without two left hands, maybe two right hands. I don't know. We might cut off one on this side here and then reattach it over on this side here. It's like, hey, let's shake hands, everybody. I don't know. It's some kind of weird thing or whatever. By the way, if you're reading comic books, there's a character in the Deadpool series now. He's been around before the Deadpool series started doing this stuff, called Terror Inc. One of the guy's things is, he's not, I don't know, he's probably a zombie, maybe he's not a zombie, he could be a zombie. It's kind of, they don't really want to explain it too much, I don't think. But one of his abilities is, he loses a body part, and then he just takes off somebody else's body part, puts it back on, and he gets their memories, and is like, look, I got a new hand. Woohoo, let's see what I can do. Ah, oh, I can fire a gun. Boom, 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 boom. He didn't have that skill before, but he does while he has his new hand on. It's just an amusing, anecdotal, side, kind of random, throw it in there kind of thing. Because, you know, that's what I do. I like to do the random, because the beast is loose upon the world. We name it not, for to give it a name is to give it strength. To put an identity upon its brow is to bring it succor and safety from surely fates. Surely, with but a wave of a hand, the flick of a finger, the batting of an eye, and all things would cease to amaze even the most dangerous of creatures that sing and dance through the shadow and silent soliloquy, their journey one of peaceful countenance, their path, the lands of the dead, are a holiday scape from those they've just read. The next topic I want to talk about is Belgium's treaties with Russia. I know nothing about that. So we'll make stuff up. Why will we make stuff up? Because we are writers. That's what we do. We make stuff up. We suppose that Belgium has treaties with Russia in order to facilitate economical relationships that keep both powers, you know, well entrenched with money and stuff and resources and goods and things that make, I'm sure, in Belgium, they're very happy to have a country like Russia buying lots of stuff. And I'm sure the vice versa goes as well. But other than that, I really don't know what the hell they're doing there. They just sort of like, they're over there in Europe and Asia and all that stuff over there, and they're doing stuff. I mean, there's a lot of stuff going on over there, not just that particular relationship of things going on there. I'm sure there's a whole bunch of other stuff going on too, but I still don't know why anybody would be interested in treaties between Belgium and Russia. Russia's kind of like in the sourpuss side of the world right now, because everybody's like, oh, look, Russia, poo-poo, they're so bad. They do all these bad things in the world. And then other people in the world are saying, oh, look at Russia, they're trying to help the world. They're doing stuff over there. And I was like, really? We don't really know what they're doing over there, but they kind of might be doing some good things, and they might be doing some bad things, and really, it's hard to say. So I'm not even going to really talk about it too much, other than say, hey, Belgium, treaties with Russia, or vice versa. Maybe in consequence of concurrent elements going both directions, maybe even going opposite directions. Maybe it's more like the anarchy star, where they're actually radiating out from a central point, and then they're going in every direction away from it, and it's just chaos. Chaos. I think chaos is good. Chaos, you know what chaos is good for? Chaos is good for a comic book series called Lady Death. You ever get the opportunity, read that stuff. It's awesome. And it's fun to look at too, because they have some really good artwork in that series, and good stories, and like big swords and fiery demons and stuff. And moving on. The world burns. Each moment it births again. A red rain of fire. A glorious stream of splatter. The dead walk the earth, and the living hide in shame amongst the brambles of the woods. Each day is a gift to the dead, as we are the future, the things that shuffle through shadows with tireless dread. We sing to the silence, we dance to the violence. Each brush against the future is merely another cut, another suture. Let's talk about now, society's perceptions of what self should be. That's a very difficult one to do. It's difficult and easy at the same time, because what it really boils down to is that a lot of people in this world are, in my opinion, really going with the flow rather than trying to create their own personal impression of what they should be. We look at magazines, we look at how magazines and fashion, high fashion, how high? They're pretty high. They're smoking some good stuff, I'm sure of it. Or doing other things, but we'll stick with the smoking. You look at some of the images of these people. I mean, young girls, young boys, and that's not what real people look like. Real people look like real people. As the expression goes, real women have curves, etc. That's actually a much more healthy approach to life, is be happy with the way you are, learn to find the balance between what's pretty and what's functional and what's personally well-attuned for the individual's body, soul, mind, heart, all that stuff. And I'm going to use this word a lot. I should probably stop doing that. Maybe if I start hitting myself in the head each time I do it, I'll probably stop doing it. Maybe either that or just have a headache. I don't know, one or the other. So the issue of identity, self-image, all of these complex interworking elements of social and individual self-constructs is a weird kind of thing to think about every once in a while. And as a writer and as a poet and as a person who likes to think and eat many cookies, it's the kind of thing that I like to think about sometimes. And then now, as I have this particular thing called a radio show, I can express these opinions. And by the way, these are my opinions and not necessarily those of anybody else in the radio show or the station or anywhere in the world. I don't really know, whatever. That's how we're experimenting. We're trying to find out whether or not there are people who share my opinions or whether or not they're going to think, well, man, that's just whack. So, self-identity, self-image. It's a very important thing a lot of days, because I've had friends who've been through the whole suicide thing, and hopefully most of them have not found that way and gone down that dark path and have instead found a much more healthy balance to their lives to just be whatever it is that works for them. So with the self-image thing coming from the way that marketers and advertisers and companies want to impress is like, oh, this is the perfect image of what a person should look like. The reality is, who's perfect? Who's normal? Who's right? Who's wrong? Really, there isn't any. None of these things have a mean standard of measurement that you can say, that's what a perfect woman should look like, and that over there is what a perfect man should look like, and between these two there should be nothing else. Nobody should be a pound more or a pound less than these two perfect idioms of existence. That's perfect, that's perfect, and they're going to have perfect people together, and then there's going to be nothing else except a world of perfect people, and it's like, and blah, 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 that whole line of banter and record or blah, 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 is just silly. People should, I guess, really, it sounds like I'm trying to be forceful now, too, and I'm not. I'm really just trying to say that people should be able to figure out for themselves what works best for the individual. Because what works good for me is not necessarily going to work good for every other person in the world. And there's like 6+ billion people in the world, and I'm pretty darn sure not every single one of them. I'm pretty darn sure that not even a fraction. Well, maybe a tiny fraction. I don't know how much of a small fraction. Maybe a teensy weensy 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 weeny leeny eeny beady 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 kind of fraction might share the same kind of body shape, image shape, mind shape, social shape, whatever you want to call any of these labels. Yeah, it's a label, man. What do we want? Oh, labels. I'm going to talk about labels now, too. in the box. It's like the whole concept of thinking outside of the box and thinking inside of the box. I read an interesting article the other day about that. That was pretty interesting because, you know, it was interesting, so obviously I read it, about how thinking outside the box is not necessarily the right idiom that people should identify and attach to when they're trying to motivate creative, because sometimes outside of the box is like way too far outside of the box. And it's great to work that as an experiment to see, hey, how far out of the box can we go to come up with a possible solution or possible creative direction for something? The idea being, though, if you want to achieve something realistic, There's a meter stick you want to go by. Over here, that would be great if we could do that, because that would be awesome, and then everybody would be happy, and everybody would have everything they ever wanted. But reality, realistically, relativistically, and any other word that starts with real, how likely is it that we could get to that? Probably not very likely. So, if we then modify that, it's like saying, within this box, within these parameters, how can we make better? How can we make things gooder? How can we make things that people actually like and want and are participatory to indicate that it's a fun thing? It's something that actually works towards what everybody else wants. And then everybody's happy. And if everybody's happy, then obviously it's a positive environment. And then things all move from there. So sometimes the whole extrapolated expression becomes much more about the message rather than the meaning of the message, and that's all part of that whole marketing thing and advertising and self, how we identify ourselves amongst comparisons with others, and that creates a whole lot of animosity and self-doubt. And I, as much as I can, like as an example with this particular episode of the show, what I'm trying to do here, or at least at this particular portion of it, is trying to identify and say, you don't need to. I mean, what somebody else has as far as what their personal body space is, what their intellectual mental space is, what the people are capable of doing, it's not necessarily what you are. You are an individual. You are a person, a perfect snowflake, and however you want to go with that particular metaphysical mantra or whatever you want. But you're an individual. And as an individual, you are not going to be the same as any other individual. Everybody's going to be different. Now, there's going to be shades of compatibility. I mean, otherwise we wouldn't have a society. A society of, like, say, an 80%, 20% mix of where 80% of people get along, 20% don't. Then we have to find ways to keep everybody in a comfort zone that says, hey, we don't get along, but you guys are an important part of the society anyways. So we have to keep finding ways to make everybody fit in areas. Oh, wait, that all sounds like it's inside the box. And then when we do all of these things inside the box, then we start creating all these labels, and the labels are all kind of silly. Come on, horror as a genre in writing is it's an exploration of possibilities for what things could happen, how scary things are. And originally, I think a lot of horror originally started as morality stories. I mean, you look at the Grimm fairy tales. All of these fairy tales are about scary, scary, scary stuff, but they're all intended to show and demonstrate a series of, well, if you do a bad thing, bad things are going to happen. So don't do that bad thing, because if you do that bad thing, then you'll have to deal with that bad other circumstances. And who really wants to become that? Nobody. Don't do that. Pshaw. So, you know, it's all rolling back into the whole self-image and identity thing. We as a society, as a species, humanity, keeps trying to push the edge of where that blurs the whole concept of what is the self versus the commonality. I've read a number of books in which the whole gestalt mind, hey, look, everybody's part of one think thought, and it's a giant world. Julian May wrote this one book series called, I can't remember the name of, but I do remember the one book's name, The Non-Born King, in which there was a very far future in which everybody was part of a human hive mind. And some people would sometimes break off of the hive mind to travel back in time to explore and experience individuality and that whole sort of stuff. And it was actually really interesting, really cool story. Worthwhile reading. If you haven't read it, you should probably take it up in book and read it. It's interesting, fun stuff. But again, we as a society keep pushing towards this commonality where, on one hand, are we trading off our individuality in order to respect the fact that commonality. There's always been this big buzz now for the last, I don't know, 2 or 3 decades or whatever, about political correctness in the way that we talk and the way that we interact with people, saying, hey, you can't use that expression or that phrase, da 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 da, because that might be offensive. Your face might be offensive. It's a very difficult one to go on, because I agree, sometimes one should be a little bit more considerate of other people around them. It's like, okay, well, I'm not going to try and obviously make a joke about one type of group of people when I'm amongst a group of that type of people, because obviously they're not going to appreciate that. Well, they might. You never know. I mean, people have a good sense of humor. They're going to enjoy a good joke. But realistically speaking as well, they might not. So yeah, you got to understand what the environment you're working in, playing in. You can't just go and be a racist bastiche in some consideration places, because that's just not going to play well. They might actually not appreciate that, and you might not be called back for the cookies. And it's like, oof, then you'll be told right there, and that's just not cool. So we have to be considerate of other people. But I think political correctness, this whole overt political correctness thing of, oh yes, no trigger words, no, blah, 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 is going to lead to just a boring society of people who are just like completely boring. And they don't make good cookies, you know. Boring people don't make good cookies. Interesting people make good cookies. And that's a very important part of my platform about the future. And, oh, I just touched on another topic for the randomness, was cookies. So we'll conclude that one as well. That's done. And, see, I have a checklist. I've got a checklist. The checklist says these things I must talk about tonight, because I have a whole hour to talk with myself. And I'm fascinated by the depths of which I can actually keep talking. And this is all going to be done, just so everybody knows, in one single take. The only edit on this particular take is going to be at the beginning to make sure I didn't really flub up that one fudgy thing, or at the very end where I say, okay, it's tied all together, and it's like, oh, it's done. There will be no song in the middle of this particular episode. There will be no distractions in this episode. I won't even let the squirrels get anywhere nearer to me, nor the monkeys, nor the dead things. Like, okay, there's a dead thing sitting over there. What the hell is that dead thing doing? Ooh, interesting. I wonder what he's going to do with that. Oh, that's not good. Well then, I think the starfish there just basically got split in half, and if you are a follower of Cthulhu, hail Cthulhu. And moving right along, lead me not into the light, nor follow me further into the night. I am a creature of the in-betweens. I live for the moment and die each and every other one besides. The cast of shadows spill at my feet, and I meant spill at my feet, and use my blood for umbrellas, my entrails for seasoning of their despair. Each day is a gift, each day is a curse. There is no finding which is better or which is worse. The next topic we're going to talk about right now is lemurs. I don't know why either, but they're funny looking. And they're very Lemurian? Yeah. And if you know what Lemuria is, it's the other name for the, well, not necessarily the other name for, but another concept extrapolation for in literature for the ancient island of Atlantis. But it's not really Atlantis, it's Lemuria. It's a whole other thing. And it's like, whatever. Read it. Go read a book. It's good for you. Next item we're going to talk about is corporate extortion and its effect on global commercial fornication. Well, we'll just leave that word there for you, and we'll go on a bit and talk about corporate extortion. Well, here's the thing. If people, and I hear a lot of people say this, that big industry, big companies, all of these corporate, financial, mega giant, by the way, you know, there's some really good comic books and storybooks and stuff like that that use this whole idea of the giant corporations and how they exist and they control the future. If you haven't read Judge Dredd before, read Judge Dredd. It's really cool. It's got some cool ideas. And then, of course, it's got I Am the Law. But that's only because that's the Sylvester Stallone version. But it's also the comic book version, where it's actually even better than the Sylvester Stallone version. Because, really, he wasn't really the best Judge Dredd. Carl Urban, in that movie that came out, Dredd, was actually really awesome and cool done. And actually much closer to the comic book than I could have expected. And I actually think I want to watch that movie again some point soon. Maybe I'll watch it tonight. Nah, I probably won't watch it tonight. But very fun movie to watch if you haven't watched it. But and also a very strong exploration of the whole corporate identity taking over the world and basically trying to pigeonhole people as merely just a resource for the entire supply chain for that commerce structure. So a lot of people don't like the fact that big companies exist. A lot of the news in the recent days, I guess in the last decade or so, the whole idea as to whether or not a company has an identity or is a person under the tenets of the law. That's a really strong and strange thing to try and understand, because is a company really a person? Not really. Not in my book. It's not really. But as far as a taxable entity, I would say yes, because if it earns money, it should be paying taxes, and paying the taxes helps create the society and all of the other elements of society that, like, everybody's involvement goes through and every other company's involvement goes through. And I really don't like this whole throwing people their money, like the companies throwing, sheltering their money in, like, offshore savings things. It's like, that shouldn't just be a thing. I mean, if you make money in the country, you should pay taxes of that money in that country. I mean, let's be fair. Let's not be greedy. I mean, the governments of the world don't necessarily need to take all of the money from all the companies, because otherwise, if they do that, what's the point of the company in trying to make money? Companies in and of themselves want to make money. That's how their existence, that's their basic foundation. That is their basic truism within and of themselves. And each person who wants to run a company, an entrepreneur, a person who's trying to get into a business world, trying to build something for themselves, for their families, for their friends, for their community, for any of those elements of building, there has to be more than just altruism, because that doesn't really work as a business construct. It can work alongside a business contract. I want to create a nice company that does good things for the world and at the same time makes money for me and people. People that I employ, people that work with me, people that I work with, companies that I interact with. All of these things, it's a large dynamic of things interacting that, on one hand, is great to be altruistic, but on the other hand, it needs to be profitable, or it needs to actually show some kind of form of profit, some means in which there is a drive towards a goal of profitability. Because otherwise, what is the point of a company doing stuff like that? You know? It's like, yeah. So yeah, I mean, companies, they exist, and they serve that very vital, important function within the ecology of how society works. Without the component that makes, hey, I need to make money, and money just really is a tool. It's not actually a thing. Money is worthless. It is completely and utterly complete fabricated environment to, not an environment, it's a tool. It's a thing by which we use the measurement of, how did you do today, Johnny? I did really good today, sir. I made $5. Oh, that's awesome. What can you do with that $5? I can buy a loaf of bread. I can buy a jug of milk. I can buy a bag of cookies, and I can have myself a pate. So, that's great. That's awesome. So that $5 takes you a long way. Yes, it does. Okay, you've worked a great day. Go have that fun and party with that bag of chips and milk and cookies and bread and stuff. So without the corporate environment, without that whole fiscal financial thing, you don't get that level of transition from I got stuff to I got other stuff. You're working with the cave dweller / agrarian environment where I worked a hard day. What'd you do? I sowed a field with flour. Okay, awesome. What do you do after that? Reap it. And then what do you do after that? Sleep. Do stuff. And these are very important. Don't get me wrong. These farmers are a very important part of the structure as well, because they build the food that the rest of us in the society and the rest of this culture eat, consume, and mass. Mass. So, without the one, there is not the other. Now, the whole bit about corporate fornication. Well, sorry, commercial fornication, because I just like saying the word fornication. Fornication-ation. Wait a second. That actually sounds like a good tag jingle line. I might... Ooh. Now I'm thinking. What am I thinking? I'm thinking of drinking. No, I'm not thinking of drinking. I'm thinking of sinking. No, I'm not going to sink either because I don't want to sink. Oh, I don't even remember how much. I hit a button and I did a thing ding. I rang a ding ding and a ding a ding ling. I have no idea what I was going with that, but we'll keep going with it and see what happens. Oh, I have to slap my head when I do that again. Yeah. So, did you watch Walking Dead? Walking Dead is cool. I totally... By the way, spoilers! Walking Dead, Season 6, Episode 9. The first episode for the return of the mid-season, current season. Oh my god, Daryl had the big missile launch. The bikers blew up. Oh jeez, that was awesome. I just had to throw that in there because, you know, corporate fornication. Getting back to that, what are my opinions on commercial fornication? Well, there is... All business is not bad, you know? Obviously, a lot of it rampant, running free, left on its own devices, it's continuously going to go towards... If you put it in Dungeons & Dragons terms, businesses are true epitome, the epitome, however you want to pronounce that word, of true neutral. Because they are self-serving. They do not serve any other function other than to continue the existence and expand the persistence of that entity. That's what a business does. It continues, and it continues, and it continues. And that's all it's trying to do, is to create more and continue and an existence that keeps pushing forward for that entity. That's what a business does. That's all a business cares about. It does not care about the components of what it is. It does not care about the things it affects, nor is affected by it. However, that's why society is a better thing. Businesses are run by people. People make the choices as to whether or not that business is good or bad, whether or not that business keeps going forward in a negative manner or in a positive one. I want to see more businesses that are actually focused on trying to work with the community and with the environment and with the whole architecture of existence. Reality is, probably not going to happen like that. Not until I take over the world. When I take over the world, all of these companies are going to work well together because otherwise I'm going to eat them. And you know what's going to happen when I eat them? I'm going to eat with cookies. Moving forward. So, I don't know how commercial fornication works. I mean, what? Two companies get together and they have a share of cigarette and then they end up in bed and they go, hey, you want a shag? It's like, well, maybe they've said that before they ended up in bed. Maybe they say that after they ended up in bed. Maybe there's like a joint agreement that occurs between the two and they say, okay. And then they go. You know, and then they have a couple of other commercial entities that come out. It's like, look, the little ones all over the place. And it's like, okay, moving off that topic because that didn't sound right anymore. Ha! They looked up and gazed toward the horizon's edge. White wisps of snow curled around every corner, every space, every angle conceivable, in every direction, for miles upon miles upon miles. Together, they held each other's hand, watched their breath escape from the tenuous grip they still maintained upon their souls. Step by step, they pushed forward, the realization that there was no escape from this barren landscape, that there was no miracle rescue coming to take them away, that no amount of effort was likely to give them pause from their fateful end. Yet still they walked, slogging through the snow, pushing onwards, onwards, onwards. They had stopped talking hours ago, for their words were already all said. They had stopped looking at each other, for they had already seen all that there was to be seen. Instead, they kept walking. Any direction was as good as the next, so long as they kept going. Neither of them noticed the snow as it began to sift along the edge of the cliff that they were walking along. Neither of them saw the darkening of the sky above them as the wall of snow rushed towards them. Neither of them cared to stop, for it mattered not, for they both knew they were already dead hours ago. Ooh, that was a little story that I just put together like there. So, I had two other topic conflicts to throw in here. Babylonian irrigation techniques. Draw a line in the dirt, connect it to the water, direct it over to where the food is. Irrigation! Yay! Making more food easier and faster for everybody. That's about all I'm going to say on that one. And I already did cookies. Yes. Let's mark that tick box off the list here. And corporate extortion. Yep, we did that one too. Okay, awesome. What is random? How do we define random? Random is complex interactions of elements at a level that necessarily may not coincide with what we think relates to one thing or the other. So, I mean, A might not relate to egg, but egg might relate to dinosaur in a way that may make sense. It's ipso facto, you know. It's that whole rule of thumb that goes through. Oh, I got to say something about the word, concept, phrase, rule of thumb. I try not to use it because I know what it comes from. Do you know what it comes from? If you don't, it comes from an old... Actually, if I remember correctly, it was maybe more of a myth that it came from this expression. But if I remember correctly, there's something about an old law in, is it English or North American, very early North American law that you could not strike, you would be okay to strike a woman so long as you left no mark greater than the size of your thumb. And I always thought, that's not very cool. It's like, that's violent, that's unnecessary. And that leads me into the next segment. Violence in the world. There's an awful lot of it going on. And it makes me sad to think that humanity as a species continues to include a lot of violence in its interactions with stuff. I mean, some of it I understand. I mean, growth in any environment, in any world structure, any kind of ecology or whatever, it requires conflict, and the environment conflicts with the species that are trying to expand into any particular environment. And, well, obviously, that happens. But why do we keep attacking each other? Why do we hit each other? Why do we hurt each other? Why do we spend so much great lengths and efforts going towards trying to say, you're bad, therefore you must be punished, and if you must be punished, I must hurt you? And none of that makes sense to me. I understand anger. Anger is a very easy emotion to understand, because it's just really the inability to necessarily control with complete abstract, or not necessarily even abstract, complete understanding of what's going on. Anger is easy, but it's also easy to deflect anger. It's also easy to take anger and say, I was angry, now I'm not. I've moved on past that thing. And that's easy. But violence is unnecessary, because after you do that violence, after you commit that violence, that is a thing that you cannot ever say, I'm sorry. Because that just won't wash that away. You want to be angry? Angry's fine. Angry, you can express yourself. I'm angry. You suck. Blah, 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 blah. And then after that, you can say, well, I was angry. Now I'm not. And that's okay. But once you commit an act of violence, that's it. That is an ingrained black stain upon your soul. You have actually done something that hurts somebody, whether willfully, negligently, knowingly, unknowingly, all of those other inglies. You have done this, and that's not necessarily a cool thing. So don't do that. Just take it from the zombie. Take it from me. Take it from the zombie Bill, zombie Zach. That's me. I'm saying don't be violent. Be mellow. Chill. Spread good and happiness to the people in the world. When you see somebody, don't say, you suck! Say nothing at all if you can't say anything good. I think that was a golden rule somewhere along the way. I don't know if it's definitely not the golden rule, because that one is, do unto others as you would have others do unto you, which I think is an excellent idea, because you want people to treat you well, treat them well. They will, probably. Not necessarily always. So sometimes, you know, you got to ride the bus and then just find some other medium that goes between those two constructs and just keep going. Because the rest of the world doesn't owe you anything, and you don't owe them anything. And this also still ties back into my earlier concept about self-image and self-identity, and about how the self is not necessarily the same as everyone else, but we are still all working and living in an environment where we can work together. We can talk about things, and we can say, hey, that thing, that wasn't cool. But this thing over here, that might not be cool either. But maybe some mixture of the two would be cool. And hopefully there is a way to make a easy medium between the two. So, that's all of those. Now, I'm going to read a little bit of a thing called Frankenstein. Letter 1. St. Petersburg, December 11th, 17-something. To Mrs. Saville, England. You will rejoice to hear that no disaster has accompanied the commencement of an enterprise which you have regarded with such evil forebodings. I arrived here yesterday, and my first task is to assure my dear sister of my welfare and increasing confidence in the success of my undertaking. I am already far north of London, and as I walk in the streets of Petersburg, I feel a cold northern breeze play upon my cheeks, which braces my nerves and fills me with delight. Do you understand this feeling? This breeze, which has traveled from the regions towards which I am advancing, gives me a foretaste of those icy climes. Inspirited by this wind of promise, my daydreams become more fervent and vivid. I try in vain to be persuaded that the pole is the seat of frost and desolation. It ever presents itself to my imagination as the region of beauty and delight. There, Margaret, the sun is forever visible, its broad disk just skirting the horizon and diffusing a perpetual splendor. There, for with your leave, my sister, I will put some trust in preceding navigators. There snow and frost are banished, and sailing over a calm sea, we may be wafted to a land of surpassing in wonders and in beauty ever region hitherto discovered on the habitable globe. Its productions and features may be without example, as the phenomena of the heavenly bodies undoubtedly are in those undiscovered solitudes. What may not be expected in a country of eternal light? I may there discover the wondrous power which attracts the needle and may regulate a thousand celestial observations that require only this voyage to render their seeming eccentricities consistent forever. I shall satiate my ardent curiosity with the sight of a part of the world never before visited, and may tread a land never before imprinted by the foot of man. These are my enticements, and they are sufficient to conquer all fear and danger, or death, and to induce me to commence this laborious voyage with the joy a child feels when he embarks in a little boat, with his holiday mates, on an expedition of discovery up his native river. But supposing all these conjectures to be false, you cannot contest the inestimable benefit which I shall confer on all mankind, to the last generation, by discovering a passage near the pole to those countries, to reach which at present so many months are requisite, or by ascertaining the secret of the magnet, which, if at all possible, can only be effected by an undertaking such as mine. These reflections have dispelled the agitation with which I began my letter, and I feel my heart glow with an enthusiasm which elevates me to heaven, for nothing contributes so much to tranquillize the mind as a steady purpose, a point on which the soul may fix its intellectual eye. This expedition has been the favorite dream of my early years. I have read with ardor the accounts of the various voyages which have been made in the prospect of arriving at the North Pacific Ocean through the seas which surround the pole. You may remember that a history of all the voyages made for the purpose of discovery composed the whole of our good Uncle Thomas's library. My education was neglected, yet I was passionately fond of reading. These volumes were my study day and night, and my familiarity with them increased the regret which I had felt as a child, on learning that my father's dying injunction had forbidden my uncle to allow me to embark in a seafaring life. These visions faded when I perused, for the first time, those poets whose effusions entranced my soul and lifted it to heaven. I also became a poet, and for 1 year I lived in a paradise of my own creation. I imagined that I also might obtain a niche in the temple where the names of Homer and Shakespeare are consecrated. You are well acquainted with my failure and how heavily I bore the disappointment. But just at that time I inherited the fortune of my cousin, and my thoughts were turned into the channel of their earlier bent. 6 years have passed since I resolved on my present undertaking. I can even now remember the hour from which I dedicated myself to this great enterprise. I commenced by inuring my body to hardship. I accompanied the whale fishers on several expeditions to the North Sea. I voluntarily endured cold, famine, thirst, and want of sleep. I often worked harder than the common sailors during the day and devoted my nights to the study of mathematics, the theory of medicine, and those branches of physical science from which a naval adventurer might derive the greatest practical advantage. Twice I actually hired myself as an undermate in a Greenland whaler and acquitted myself to admiration. I must own I felt a little proud when my captain offered me the second dignity in the vessel and entreated me to remain with the greatest earnestness, so valuable did he consider my services. And now, dear Margaret, do I not deserve to accomplish some great purpose? My life might have been passed in ease and luxury, but I preferred glory to every enticement that wealth placed in my path. Oh, that some encouraging voice would answer to in the affirmative. My courage and my resolution is firm. But my hopes fluctuate, and my spirits are often depressed. I am about to proceed on a long and difficult voyage, the emergencies of which will demand all my fortitude. I am required not only to raise the spirits of others, but sometimes to sustain my own when theirs are failing. This is the most favorable period for traveling in Russia. They fly quickly over the snow and the sledges. The motion is pleasant, and in my opinion far more agreeable than that of an English stagecoach. The cold is not excessive if you are wrapped in furs, a dress which I have already adopted, for there is a great difference between walking the deck and remaining seated motionless for hours, when no exercise prevents the blood from actually freezing in your veins. I have no ambition to lose my life on the post road between St. Petersburg and Archangel. I shall depart for the later town in a fortnight or 3 weeks, and my intention is to hire a ship there, which can easily be done by paying the insurance for the owner, and to engage as many sailors as I think necessary among those who are accustomed to the whale fishing. I do not intend to sail until the month of June. And when shall I return? Ah, dear sister, how can I answer this question? If I succeed, many, many months, perhaps years, will pass before you and I may meet. If I fail, you will see me again soon, or never. Farewell, my dear, excellent Margaret. Heaven shower down blessings on you, and save me, that I may again and again testify my gratitude for all your love and kindness. Your affectionate brother, R. Walton. That's an excerpt from Dracula. And if you haven't read that book... Sorry, that's Frankenstein. Blah, I don't know what monster I'm talking about today. The whole world is full of monsters. Sorry. That was from Frankenstein, or The Modern Prometheus, by Mary Wollstonecraft Godwin Shelley. Man, sometimes reading is tough. Tough! Reading is tough. Go to school. Learn to read. Learn to write. Do some good things. Make a better life for everyone, not necessarily just yourself. So, because I was also thinking about Dracula, here's an excerpt from Dracula, Chapter 1. Jonathan Harker's Journal. 3 May, Bistritz. Left Munich at 8:35 p.m. on 1 May, arriving at Vienna early next morning. Should have arrived at 6:46, but train was an hour late. Budapest seems a wonderful place, from the glimpse which I got of it from the train and the little cab walk through the streets. I feared to go very far from the station, as we had arrived late and would start as near the correct time as possible. The impression I had was that we were leaving the west and entering the east. The most western of splendid bridges over the Danube, which is here of noble width and depth, took us among the traditions of Turkish rule. We left in pretty good time, and came after nightfall to Klausenburg. Here I stopped for the night at the Hotel Royal. I had, for dinner, or rather supper, a chicken done up some way with red pepper, which was very good, but thirsty. Mention, get recipe from Mina. I asked the waiter, and he said it was called Paprika Händel, and that, as it was a national dish, I should be able to get it anywhere along the Carpathians. I found my smattering of German very useful here. Indeed, I don't know how I should be able to get on without it. Having had some time at my disposal when in London, I had visited the British Museum and made search among the books and maps in the library regarding Transylvania. It had struck me that some foreknowledge of the country could hardly fail to have some importance in dealing with a nobleman of that country. I find that the district he named is in the extreme east of the country, just on the borders of three states, Transylvania, Moldavia, and Bukovina, in the midst of the Carpathian Mountains. one of the wildest and least known portions of Europe. I was not able to light on any map or work giving the exact locality of the Castle Dracula, as there were no maps of this country as yet to compare with our own Ordnance Survey maps. But I found that the Beet Streets, the post town named by Count Dracula, is a fairly well-known place. I shall enter here some of my notes, as they may refresh my memory when I talk over my travels with Mina. In the population of Transylvania, there are four distinct nationalities: Saxons in the south, and mixed with them the Wallachs, who are the descendants of the Dacians; Magyars in the west, and I'm not even going to try and pronounce that one, in the east and north. I am going among the latter, who claim to be descended from Attila and the Huns. This may be so, for when the Magyars conquered the country in the 11th century, they found the Huns settled in it. I read that every known superstition in the world is gathered into the horseshoes of the Carpathians, as if it were the center of some sort of imaginative whirlpool. If so, my stay may be very interesting. I must ask the Count all about them. I did not sleep well, though my bed was comfortable enough, for I had all sorts of queer dreams. There was a dog howling all night under my window, which may have had something to do with it, or it may have been the paprika, for I had to drink up all the water in my carafe, and was still thirsty. Towards morning, I slept, and was wakened by the continuous knocking at my door, so I guess I must have been sleeping soundly then. I had for breakfast more paprika, and a sort of porridge maize flour, which they said was mamaliga, and eggplant stuffed with forcemeat, a very excellent dish, which they call implatata. I had to hurry breakfast, for the train started a little before 8, or rather it ought to have done so, for after rushing to the station at 7:30, I had to sit in the carriage for more than an hour before we began to move. It seems to me that the further east you go, the more unpunctual are the trains. What ought they to be in China? All day long we seemed to dawdle through a country which was full of beauty of every kind. Sometimes we saw little towns or castles on the top of steep hills, such as we see in old missals. Sometimes we ran by rivers and streams which seemed, from the wide stony margin on each side of them, to be subject to great floods. It takes a lot of water and running strong to sweep the outside edge of the river clear. At every station there were groups of people, sometimes crowds, and in all sorts of attire. Some of them were just like the peasants at home, or those I saw coming through France and Germany, with short jackets and round hats and homemade trousers, but others were very picturesque. The women looked pretty, except when you got near them, but they were very clumsy about the waist. They had all full white sleeves of some kind or other, and most of them had big belts with a lot of strips of something fluttering from them like the dresses in a ballet, but of course there were petticoats under them. The strangest figures we saw were the Slovaks, who were more barbarian than the rest, with their big cowboy hats, great baggy, dirty, whitey trousers, white linen shirts, and enormous heavy leather belts, nearly a foot wide, all studded over with brass nails. They wore high boots, with their trousers tucked into them, and had long black hair and heavy black mustaches. They are very picturesque, but do not look prepossessing. On the stage, they would be set down at once as some old Oriental band of brigands. They are, however, I am told, very harmless and rather wanting in natural self-assertion. It was on the dark side of twilight when we got to Bistritz, which is a very interesting old place. Being practically on the frontier, for the Borgo Pass leads from it to Bukovina, it has had a very stormy existence, and it certainly shows marks of it. 50 years ago, a series of great fires took place, which made terrible havoc on 5 separate occasions. At the very beginning of the 17th century, it underwent a siege of 3 weeks and lost 13,000 people, the casualties of war proper being assisted by famine and disease. Count Dracula had directed me to go to the Golden Crone Hotel, which I found, to my great delight, to be thoroughly old-fashioned, and, of course, I wanted to see all I could see of the ways of the country. I was evidently expected, for when I got near the door, I faced a cheery-looking elderly woman in the usual peasant dress, with white undergarment with long double apron, front and back of colored stuff fitting almost too tight for modesty. When I came close, she bowed and said, "The Herr Englishman?" "Yes," I said. "Jonathan Harker?" She smiled and gave some message to an elderly man in white shirt sleeves who had followed her to the door. He went, but immediately returned with a letter. "My friend, welcome to the Carpathians. I am anxiously expecting you. Sleep well tonight. At 3 tomorrow the diligence will start for Bukovina. A place on it has been kept for you. At the Borgo Pass my carriage will await you, and will bring you to me. I trust that your journey from London has been a happy one, and that you will enjoy your stay in my beautiful land. Your friend, Dracula." So that's an excerpt from the great story of Dracula, as written by that guy, Bram Stoker. You've probably heard of him before, probably heard of the book before, and you've probably heard of the Frankenstein book before. And if you haven't, you should read them. They're very good and impressive pieces of work. Sometimes the English might be a little difficult if you're not too used to it, but they're still good to read, because reading more makes your brain bigger, makes your brain better, makes you more active as an intelligent person inside the headspace. And that is always featuring very well in the zombie world, because we like to have humans in the world that have big brains, happy brains, brains full of juicy brains. Because that's an important part of my political platform. That in, I don't know what kind of time period it is, I can't really tell you what it is, because it's very under hush, hush, lock and key, lock and key, lock and key, don't say nothing. Say nothing about it right now at the moment. We will take over this world. There is a plan. I have a plan. I have a plan that includes a lot of different elements to it, components of things and stuff that needs to happen in these individual elements that have to go 1, 2, 3, then 4, then the next one, then this one, then that one, then that one. And oh my gosh, look at that. Ooh, it's starting to work. Ooh, dum, 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 yay. And when these things all fall together, and when they come in together, and when they can work the plan together, you and everybody else that works with me is going to see a world so much nicer than before. One where everybody gets along and does what I tell them exactly, specifically. And they make sure to always give me cookies and brains. Because the zombie world, the world that I am envisioning for the future, is one that gets along. Because there's no need to fight about things, because all of the needs for everybody will be taken care of. There will not be too many people in the world, because we'll have taken care of that. We will have found a proper place for everyone. Everyone will be fitting into the society of the zombie world in the future. Everyone will have a proper place that they can be very happy to be a part of, and be happy to see, oh look, I'm a part of a happy world and a happy life. So that's the end of the show. Surprisingly enough, I did that whole thing and talked and talked and talked and talked and talked and talked and talked, and I would love to hear from you, the people who listen and the people who have comments. And feel free to drop me some comments on the Afterrot Facebook page, on Facebook in general, or what the hell, on Twitter and anywhere else that you can possibly, potentially, even other P words like Piccadilly and pistachio, and I don't really like pistachio, so I'm not going to use that P word. Just particularly apply, actually that didn't work any, but we'll throw it in anyways. Just be nice to everyone, and give me cookies, and share stuff on Facebook, and like stuff on Facebook, and let me know what you're thinking about, because I like to know. Have yourselves all a great after rotten good time, everybody. Peace.
Of a big surprise, if you go down in the woods today, you'd better go in disguise. For every bear that ever there was will gather there for certain, because today's the day that teddy bears have their pick.